Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to the next edition in our series on Deuteronomy. I have to apologise. My passage for this morning is Deuteronomy 14 and 15. Halfway through the week, when I was around about halfway through preparing the sermon, I discovered that actually we're a chapter behind where we should be, and I really should have been preaching on 13 and 14. So Deuteronomy chapter 13 is the lost chapter of the Pentateuch. It is possible that we may go back to that. So I want to apologise to Moses, to you, to my mother, my father, anybody else I can think of for missing out Deuteronomy chapter 13. You have no alternative but to forgive me. So, welcome to Deuteronomy 14 and 15. Welcome to two chapters in the book of Deuteronomy, which might, at least at first sight, seem pretty unpromising. Two chapters which might, again, on first reading, seem to have not a great deal to say to 21st century Christians living in a different age from those to whom Moses spoke all those centuries ago. These two chapters were preached to Jewish people thousands of years ago and nearly 4,000 miles away. Their living conditions were entirely different from ours. Their worldview was entirely different. Their understanding of God was different because Jesus had not yet come, and their patterns of worship differed from ours as well. This passage, without doubt, helps us to understand those ancient Jewish people, how God spoke to them and how they worshipped God. But does it really have much to say to us today? We shall see, and you can be the judge. So the first impression about Deuteronomy chapters 14 and 15 may be that they're all about laws, all about rules. And of course, the truth is that Jewish people love laws. They love rules. They're desperately important to them. To Jewish people, even to this day, there are 613 laws that they seek to live by. That's a lot of laws, isn't it? I thought the Ten Commandments were enough, but 613 laws. 365 of them are laws that say you must, and it equates to the number of days in the year. And the balance, and I have to warn you that my maths is atrocious, but I think it's 248. The balance of laws, who knew, which equates apparently to the number of bones and organs in a male body. I don't know whether it's true, I've never counted, but apparently 248 laws. Those are all negative ones, and Jewish people live by those laws every day. Well, not perhaps every single day, because some of them are sort of on hold because they relate to how Jewish people relate to the king. And of course, Israel doesn't have a king anymore. And some of them too relate to how people should worship in the temple, and the temple has gone. But nevertheless, there's a whole raft of laws that Jewish people live by. And many of them relate to what they eat and what they don't eat. And I heard a lovely story, and I've got to tell it to you. It's a sort of traditional Jewish joke. And the story tells that once upon a time, there was a Jewish rabbi. It must have been a Reformed synagogue because it was a lady. And so the Jewish rabbi, she'd always stuck by the laws. She'd always done everything kosher. But in all the years that she'd been part of the Jewish religion, which in fact was the whole of her life, of course, there was one thing she missed. Do you know how it is with vegetarians? They always say the same thing to you. I don't mind being a vegetarian. It's absolutely fine. It's no difficulty until I smell bacon cooking in the morning. Don't they? Well, it was the same for her. The one thing she really wanted to try that she never had was pork. She really wanted to taste pork, but she knew she never could. However, one day she made up her mind, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to try pork once before I die. And she went through the equivalent of the Yellow Pages, and she found that on the other side of the great city where she lived, there was a restaurant that specialised in pork. And she thought, it's so far away, that no one will ever know. So she booked a table at the restaurant. And at the appointed time, she went to the restaurant, she went in, she sat down, and a waiter brought her a menu. And she looked in the menu, and there was this long list, and it was all pig products. And she thought, well, in for a penny, in for a pound, I'm going to go for it. And she chose the porkiest meal on a porky menu. She went for suckling pig with all the trimmings. She ordered it and she waited for about half an hour. And eventually the plates came out, this huge platter with a baby pig roasted with an apple in its mouth and loads of vegetables. And there was gravy and there was applesauce, anything you could possibly think of. And she was just about to take the knife and cut some meat from the suckling pig when the door of the restaurant opened. And in came four of the people from her synagogue. Their mouths dropped open because they were caught as well as she. But the rabbi was very quick thinking because she looked at them and she looked at the pork. And she said, oh, you mustn't eat here. See, I ordered an apple and look what I got. For Jewish people, though, in all seriousness, laws are really, really important. And here, in these two chapters, 14 and 15, we have loads and loads of laws. 14, verse 1, a law on mourning the dead. Verses 2 to 21, laws on the diet, what they're allowed to eat and what they're not allowed to eat. Verses 22 to 29, laws about tithing. Chapter 15, verses 1 to 18, laws relating to creditors and to debtors. 19 to 23, laws about the firstborn. That was really weird because every single commentator I read talked about laws about the firstlings. I can't talk about firstlings. It sounds like Yoda is preaching this morning. So for me, laws about the firstborn. The laws that are left after taking out the ones relating to the king and the temple tell Jews pretty much what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do every day, as I said earlier. They say what you can eat, what you can't eat, what you can do on the Sabbath and what you can't do on the Sabbath. They will tell you about the rules about weddings, about what to do when a member of the family passes away. They will give you rules on how to welcome a baby, how you should pray, when you should pray. The list goes on and on and on. All these laws. And as I said earlier, sincere Jews still order their lives around those rules to this day, and they live strictly by them. Maggie and I went a few years ago to a bar mitzvah, that ceremony, that coming of age ceremony that happens for boys at the age of 12. In the Jewish community. And it was such a wonderful service, such a lovely thing, that I thought I'd like to take some of the children that I teach to the synagogue to have a look round so we could talk about the things that were there. And I spoke to the rabbi and he said, I can't give you a card because it's the Sabbath. He took the rule on not bearing a burden on the Sabbath day so seriously, he couldn't even put a business card in his pocket. So strict to the rules. And of course, it's really, really important that we understand the very central thought of obedience being precious to God. But in these verses, we find that obedience is not the only thing. Relationship is important too. And obedience comes out of relationship. Obedience on its own is just duty. But what we have with the God that we serve is a relationship, and out of that, a real desire to serve him. So we're going to talk about relationship with God. So wonderful to think about. Let me tell you four verses in this scripture. Let's start, if we may, with chapter 14 and the first couple of verses. Why don't you look that up? I'm just going to have a drink. So it says in verse 1, "You are the sons of the Lord your God. You shall not cut yourselves or make any baldness on your foreheads for the dead. For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. And the Lord has chosen you to be a people for his treasured possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth." Now move forward, if you would, to chapter 15, verses 4 and 5. It says there, "But there will be no poor among you, for the Lord will bless you in the land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance to possess, if only you will strictly obey the voice of the Lord your God, being careful to do all this commandment that I command you today." And now finally, to verse 12 of chapter 15. "If your brother, a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, is sold to you, he shall serve you 6 years. And in the seventh year, you shall let him go free from you." So here, hiding in these two chapters, purportedly all about rules, there are four nuggets about the relationship that God has with his people. Firstly, the people of Israel are the sons or the children of God. Secondly, they are chosen by God. Thirdly, they are blessed by God. And fourthly, because they're in a relationship with God, then they're in a relationship with each other as well. They are brothers and sisters in God. Now, none of these things are new to you. You've heard it all before, preached so much better by other people. But these things are so precious, so incredible, that their repetition can't be a bad thing. So we're going to look briefly at these four aspects of the relationship between God and his people. The first then, "You are the sons of the Lord your God. You shall not cut yourselves or make any baldness on your foreheads for the dead." So Israel here is described as God's son. It's described as God's son in other places as well. We can go back to Exodus chapter 4 and verses 22 and 23. And it reads there, "Then you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, Israel is my firstborn son. And I say to you, let my son go, that he may serve me." Hosea chapter 11 verse 1, beautiful and well-known words here. "When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt, I called my son." So God says, Israel is my son. I loved him and I delivered him from slavery in Egypt. And that fact is really important. Deuteronomy chapter 1 verse 29 says, "Then I said to you, do not be in dread or afraid of them. The Lord your God who goes before you will himself fight for you, just as he did for you in Egypt before your eyes, and in the wilderness where you have seen how the Lord your God carried you, as a man carries his son, all the way that you went until you came to this place." Israel, you are my son and you can depend on me. I won't let you down. Don't be in dread. Don't be afraid. The enemies that you will face will seem huge and dreadful, probably because they are huge and dreadful, but there's nothing to be afraid of. Your God, your Father, goes before you. He isn't some passive onlooker either. He will fight for you. And then there's this beautiful picture. All this time, Israel, God has been carrying you like a man carries his son. Watch a good dad with his child. Folks, we have our own object lesson standing at the back of the church. Watch a man with his child. Watch how he carries the child. It's a lovely thing. He cradles him, surrounds him with his protection, close to his heart. There's nothing more important to him than the welfare of his little one. It's a lovely picture. But let's move on to Deuteronomy 8 verse 5, where it says, "Know then in your heart that as a man disciplines his son, the Lord your God disciplines you." So because Israel is God's son, God will fight for Israel. God will protect Israel. God will carry Israel. And God will discipline Israel in love. You and I are children of the living God. And what was true of Israel is true of you and me as well. God will fight for us. God will protect us. God will carry us. And in love, God will discipline us too. So this is what God is saying to Israel through Moses. You are my son, and I will do everything to help you. But you can have only one God. Only one God. You can have no other. I won't share you with another God. I am your God. And your character must reflect my character. For three reasons. So that you won't bring shame on my name. So that you will come to your ultimate good. And so that others will take note of what a good and loving God I am. So you shall not cut yourselves or make any boldness on your foreheads for the dead. Don't do what those who live around you do in their worship of pagan gods. Be holy, be set apart, be different, just as your Father is holy. So let's move on to the second privilege of Israel. It says in verse 2 of chapter 14, "You are a people holy to the Lord your God, and the Lord has chosen you to be a people for his treasured possession out of all the peoples who were on the face of the earth." Wow. Israel is holy to God. It is chosen. It is a treasured possession. Now, those of you who've got really good memories will be having a sense of deja vu here. We've read these words before, or at least very similar words. They go back to chapter 7 and verse 6. "For you are a people holy to the Lord your God." It says again, "The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his treasured possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth." It wasn't because you were more in number than any other people that the Lord set his love on you and chose you, for you were the fewest of all the peoples. But it's because the Lord loves you and is keeping the oath that he swore to your fathers, that the Lord has brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. So twice in the first 14 chapters or 15 chapters, God says the same thing. You are loved, you are chosen, you are my treasured possessions. And he returns to the theme in chapter 26, verse 18. And there is this enduring link between being chosen and being loved and being treasured and being holy. Why is Israel holy? Because they are chosen. Holy means set apart at its most basic. Israel, you're set apart. Israel, you're chosen. Israel, you're here for a purpose. They are holy because God chose them. God did not choose them because they were holy. Because God could never have chosen if that were the case. He didn't choose them because there was any great goodness in them. He chose them because he loved them. These words are really precious and really important for us to take on board. They're chosen because, well, certainly not because of their sinful perfection or their sinless written perfection or their strength of numbers. But they're chosen because God is gracious, because God is merciful, and God treasures them. I find that so amazing. God treasures these sinful people. If only they'd realized that fact in more than just an intellectual way. If only they'd lived as the treasured people of God, rejoiced in him, gloried in him, and their special place in his heart, instead of grubbing around trying out the ways of the nations around about them. What days they would have had. But God's love for them never changed. His promises never failed. Israel were sons of God and they were chosen by him as a treasured possession. And that's one of the reasons that God gives the Israelites laws, like the ones set out in these two chapters. Obey these laws, Israel, and you'll be set apart from the nations around about you. You'll be a holy people, but you must live differently from those nations. Your attitude to food must be different. Your attitude to wealth and possessions must be different too. And how you relate to those to whom you owe money or from whom you owe money. All these things must be different and they must mark you out as being set apart from God. The world is watching, and you must be different. Here's the third privilege. Chapter 15, verse 4. There will be no poor among you, for the Lord will bless you in the land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance to possess. If only you will strictly obey the voice of the Lord your God, being careful to do all this commandment that I command you today. Wow, that's a difficult verse, isn't it? There will be no poor among you. Difficult, especially in light of verse 11, which says, there will never cease to be poor in the land. The consensus on this, squaring the circle, you like, is that there are two explanations. Why, in one verse it says there'll be no poor among you, and a few verses later it says there'll never cease to be poor amongst you. Let me tell you what these two are, and you make your choice. The first is that there will be no poor among you is a command or a target. Listen, people of Israel, it's your responsibility that there are no poor amongst you. I don't go with that, but that's one possibility. The other one is this, that there will be no poor amongst you is dependent upon the next verse. Because the next verse says, there'll be no poor among you if only you will strictly obey the voice of the Lord your God, being careful to do all this commandment that I command you today. The wonderful possibility here is that because God has taken Israel as his son, and because God has chosen Israel out of all the nations on earth, God will richly bless Israel if only they will strictly obey the voice of the Lord their God. And of course, this refers back to a sermon from Jim a couple of weeks ago. Israel's record on obedience is pretty dire. They've turned away from God over and over and over again. But what mercy and grace we see here as once more Moses comes to the people of God and tells them that God has still got plans for them. God still has got good things ahead for them despite their sin and apostasy. God's instinct, brothers and sisters, is to bless. He's a gracious, wonderful God who loves to bless his people. Those blessings are undeserved, unmerited, unwarranted. And yet he gives and gives and gives again, exceedingly, abundantly, more than they or we could ever imagine or think. God blesses Israel. He is the God of second chances, just as we heard a couple of weeks ago. And so we come to the fourth blessing. Seven times, not once or twice, but seven times. In chapter 15, the word brother is used. It's really important, ever so important. When God chose Israel and took it as his son, he made a nation of brothers. And lest you women think, what about us? In verse 12 it says, if your brother, a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman. So both are included in that term, brother, there. So he made of Israel a nation of brothers and sisters, a brotherhood where every individual has a responsibility for every other brother. Let me read it in verse 10 of 15. You shall give to them, that is your poor brother, freely. And your heart shall not be grudging when you give to them, when you give to him, because for this the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in all that you undertake, for there will never cease to be poor in the land. Therefore, I command you, you shall open wide your hand to your brother, to the needy and to the poor in your land. So this is wonderful, isn't it? A nation chosen by God, adopted as sons of God, blessed by God, and bound together in love for each other and love for God. And I wonder if that reminds you of anyone else you know. Or does it? What a privileged people we are as Christians. We are not Israel. But because of Jesus, every single privilege that was bestowed upon Israel has become ours. My friends, we have been chosen by God. You have been chosen by God. If you're a son or daughter of his today, it's because he chose you. In 14:2 of Deuteronomy, Moses is speaking to the Jewish people. For you are a people holy to the Lord your God, and the Lord has chosen you. But Peter takes up the theme gloriously in 1 Peter 2 verse 9 when he says, you are a chosen race. You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession. And he tells us why, does Peter? He says, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Do you see that Peter puts these things in tandem, just as Deuteronomy 14 does? Being chosen, being holy, and being treasured. Deuteronomy 7 did the same thing. You are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for what? For his treasured possession. As of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. Here's the thing, brothers and sisters. If you're a Christian today, it's because God chose you and called you. That is wonderful. It is so gracious. And if you're wondering why he called you, why he chose you, I can tell you the answer. It was not because you were more in number than any other people that the Lord set his love on you and chose you. For you were the fewest of all the peoples. But it's because, this is what scripture says, it's not what I'm saying, but it's because the Lord loves you. Here is an awesome fact worthy of much consideration. If you're a Christian today, or you believe that God is calling you today, it's because he loves you. It's not because you deserve to be chosen. It's because the Lord loves you. It's not because you're powerful or wealthy or righteous or deserving of praise. We're just like the people to whom Moses was speaking. We are chosen. We are called to be holy. And we're called to proclaim the excellencies of him who called us. Because we're loved. Because we're his treasured possession. And I wonder how that makes you feel. How does it make you feel to know that the creator of the universe loves you? You are in the center of his love. You are his treasured possession. And he has chosen you. For the Jews, it meant that they lived different lives to those around about them, abstaining from certain things and doing certain things in order to be identified as chosen and loved. But what about us? If people outside of the church sees the way we live, can they tell that we're different? Are we careful to avoid anything that God in his word has identified as not worthy of him? Do we really do good to all men, especially to those who are of the household of faith, our brothers and sisters? And do we even begin to understand what it means to be loved by God, to be chosen by him? Way back when I was in school, I don't know if they still do this horrible thing these days, but whenever we were doing games or PE, you know, the teacher would get the two biggest lads at the front, you know, the best sportsmen, and then they would pick teams. Do they still do that now? It may have been banned by now. I was always one of the last ones to be chosen for any team. If it had been a chess team, it had been a team for picking up the cutlery after dinner, I'd have still been the last one to be chosen without any shadow of doubt. I was never chosen, never ever chosen, until it came to the very end. And then I wasn't chosen because I was good enough, I was just making up the numbers. But do you know what? And this is delightful to me. Do you know what? In God's church, none of us are good enough. That's great, isn't it? None of us are good enough. We'd never get picked. Not one of us would ever get picked. The Jews in Moses' time were small in numbers and strength, but God still chose them. Now we're small in numbers and strength, but God chose us. And no one got left behind. Just look around you, brothers and sisters. We are small in numbers because it's August. But September's coming. We are indeed small in numbers. But we have preachers and teachers, wonderful worship leaders. People are outstanding at that most precious gift of hospitality. Experts at what I think of as the dark arts of technology. But every single one of us is chosen and equally loved, whether we do any one of those things or whether we do none of them, equal before a loving God, equally loved as a son or daughter of that God and chosen by him. No stars, no celebrities, no first team players or also-rans. We stand, none of us good enough, and all of us equal. Each of us, brothers and sisters, equally loved and equally valued, and each of us called equally to proclaim the excellencies of him who called us out of darkness into his marvelous light. Israel stood on the verge of a new chapter in its history, brought to this place by the grace of God. And Moses says to them, "The Lord will bless you in the land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance to possess. If only you will strictly obey the voice of the Lord your God, being careful to do all this commandment that I command you today." Brothers and sisters, Hill City Church stands on the verge of a new chapter in its history. Emmaus Chapel is no longer a congregational church. It belongs to Hill City Church. And of this, I am sure, he will bless us in this new venture, if only we will strictly obey the voice of the Lord our God, being careful to do all the commandments that he commands us, not led by good ideas or expediency, but led by the will and purpose of God. God has chosen us. He has named us his sons and daughters. He calls us his treasured possession. He will bless us in the days ahead as we are obedient to him and only him, and as we work together as brothers and sisters in love, caring for each other, supporting each other, and loving each other. May the Lord bless you.